Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live this hour from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB Sioux Falls Studios. Now, in 2014, Jolene's Law Task Force was convened to study the impact of child sexual abuse in South Dakota. The group was named for Jolene Letcher, a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and South Dakota State Senator Deb Soholt served as chair. Now, Jolene has been with us several times on In the Moment, and every time we get done with our conversation, we always say, this is important, we need to talk about it again, and so here we are. Here we are with an hour dedicated to the South Dakota Center for the Prevention of Childhood Maltreatment for a conversation about protecting our children, building resilient communities. And joining us today around the table, we have Jolene, who is a survivor and an advocate. Jolene, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
Also with us, we have Cameron Corey with DCI.
Hey, Cam. Good afternoon.
Dr. Nancy Free is with Child's Voice at Sanford Health. Dr. Free. And Carrie Sanderson is director for the Center for the Protection of Childhood Maltreatment. And Carrie, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, Jolene, let's start with you because we need to go back before we can go forward.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the history of this of this center that really begins before the Jolene's Law Task Force. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of explain in a relatively
brief amount of time?
Yeah, how do you sum it up? Well, how do you sum it up for people? Because it is a lifetime for you.
It is the embodiment of the worst thing that happened to me, making the most profound change across our state. And that really started for me having been a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And you and I have talked so many times, and I still, like, my stomach churns every time. And knowing that for me to heal, it meant putting my story out there and giving voice to thousands of South Dakota children who don't have a voice or are not at that place that they can speak about what happened to them. So I started sharing my story publicly, and in 2012, the state of South Dakota, with Senator Mark Johnston, repealed the statute of limitations on criminal rape in some cases. That conversation, when you think about the context of 2012, that's before Me Too. It's before Penn State and Jerry Sandusky. It was pivotal to see this state taking a lead in how do we protect victims. And from there, in 2014, Senator Deb Soholt had approached me and said, this issue is so big, and how do we wrap our arms around it, and what do we do to protect our children, and would you be willing to put your name and your voice to legislation to help us end it? It was a decision I struggled with because it isn't just my story, and it isn't just my name. It may say Jolene's Law initially, but when you look at what it's become, the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment is representative of all of the lives and the hope and the possibility that exist in this state. And so 2014 is when we came forward initially with the Jolene's Law Task Force, of which here are three of those original folks. And that grew into this belief that I firmly and adamantly will hold on to, that in 10 years we are going to eradicate not only child abuse but child maltreatment.
It was a big ask for you to say yes to and to think about, and these are some pretty big goals, especially when you start off not really knowing how big the problem is.
Yeah.
So do you want to stick with you and talk about some of those early challenges to figure out how widespread is this? People see it in their communities, they see it in their work, but how do you put a number on what's happening in the state of South Dakota?
When we started in 2014, unanimous approval across the state legislature and really with an incredible support from Governor Dugard back then, I think we all went into it thinking we're going to go into a meeting, we're going to come out with some plans, we're going to bring forward some legislation, and you know, this, that, and the other, and here we go. And we walked into one of those very first meetings in one of the darker, dingier conference rooms at the Capitol. And I think we all had, you know, this bright hope in our heart, and the room was a little, you know, it was a conference room, right? And we all looked around and we're like, okay, so how many kids? how many kids this year? Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think Cam said, well, you know, there's, well, this and that, and they report, and then Dr. Free goes, well, them, and da-da-da. And there was this palatable moment that we all looked around and realized, we don't actually know. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world of data, right, where we characterize our lives in 140 characters, and yet to end one of the most profound issues facing our children, we couldn't tell you how many children were impacted.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a lot of times I saw it singularly. And I don't mean for that to sound selfish, but I knew one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I couldn't tell you how many others.
Yeah.
And that for me was a really stunning moment.
Dr. Free, go ahead.
And I think for us, that was something that we brought to the table as a frustration. Yeah. Because we both knew how many children were counted in each of our disciplines. And we knew there was some crossover, but we knew there were lots of children who weren't counted by either one of us or other agencies. And this is really just taking into account the children who are disclosing.
The children who are disclosing,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or who are witnessed or recognized right. in some way by some professional body. And we know that that's probably just the beginning. We know it's just the beginning.
Right.
The tip of the iceberg, so to speak.
And I want to get at this before we go into the work of this, mm-hmm. this group. You are really making a commitment at this point to be talking about something, and maybe other people have personal stories and know people and you know through your work, but you're going to be in this for a long time, but you're going to be in it not alone. Talk about that a little bit and how that has, over the months and the years, just showing up again and again, but then showing up again and again now with a...
I have a team.
A team, mm-hmm. yeah.
I have this beautiful team. Yeah. And I will get a little teary-eyed because... we had some fights along the way.
We
had some hurdles legislatively that we had to get through. And I still remember, as much as I always want to be the advocate in those roles, I'm still, part of me is always a victim. Part of me is always a child, and I have to relive that trauma. And every time when I would get done testifying, Dr. Free and Cam would be back in that audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember during one of our struggles where I think we truly believed this work was going to come to an end, that all we had put forward was going to be done. My husband was on one side of me, and I just remember shaking and thinking, all of this, and there's gonna be all these Jolene's that are left mm-hmm. with no one to help them. And my husband's on one side, Cam's on the other, and I still remember both of you
mm-hmm.
just kind of coming in by my side and holding my hand. And that was just incredibly powerful. And I think I said some expletives, probably.
probably both.
I think we both did. And I knew, like, I had my home support, right. my husband right there, but like, I had Cam.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many times I have turned to him, and I've seen someone that day in and day out does this fight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That I wished, you know, could have been there when I was younger. And then Dr. Free, who understands the power of having a victim's mm-hmm. voice, and the compassion of what it means to relive it, mm-hmm. and how many hugs I've gotten mm-hmm. as well. And early on, as we were doing this work, probably the second or third meeting, I just had this, you know, gasp, and I thought, what if this had been 30 years ago or 40 years ago? Mm. How different would my life be? Mm-hmm. And I looked around and I saw these people that were so committed to this work. And at that point, we didn't know how many people it was impacting. Mm-hmm. That was even before we had right. head numbers.
Right.
Yeah.
One of those hurdles, I'm guessing, is, and Cam, I want to bring you in for this question, is that we have people in different agencies. It's not as if nobody's ever been working with this type. You know, there's been mm-hmm. there have been victims for decades. There have been cases and,
right.
and prosecutions and physicians involved. There might be a tendency to think, like, we're already doing this. Like, we've put so much work and training into this. One of the hurdles is to sort of reimagine how can we do this together in a new way and collaborate. Speak to that a little bit, if you will, of just trying to figure out how do you open yourself as a professional to say, maybe there's a better way.
Right. So, you know, that's a really good question. And I have used myself as an example in that. When I was very young, and I've been doing this now for about 21 years in law enforcement, and specifically working child maltreatment crimes, sexual assault crimes for 15 years. And I was very young, probably about 24 years old, and I was handed a case of a four-year-old child who was disclosing being sexually abused. And there wasn't anybody else to work that case. It was my very first case of a sexual abuse, and I am entrusted with a four-year-old child and her mother. And, you know, I did the best that I could at that time. And afterwards, I remember we went to trial. It was a jury trial, and the defendant was acquitted of that. And after that happened, that mother came in and gave me a little bear, police bear, and next to it was a little bear of a little girl, and says, you know, this represents my daughter and you. You stood by us through this whole time. And so that's what started me going down this path of realizing that I can make a difference in people's lives, whether we get a conviction or not. And I also realized I have a lot to learn. And so with myself, I made it a point to get training, education, and my agency sent me across the United States to get this advanced education and bring it back to South Dakota and teach law enforcement officers and many others. So since 2006, I've been teaching the law enforcement officers in South Dakota how to respond to sexual assault crimes. But there's still a lot more to go. You know, we talked about going to that first meeting, and I am asked to be part of this group because I'm an expert in this field. And I sat there listening, and I thought, wow, I'm not an expert. There's a lot I don't know. And I think that that's what goes on, and we need to recognize in the law enforcement community, really any professional community, that while we're working these cases, we don't know it all. And that's why it's so important of creating this multidisciplinary team, that I don't have all the answers. People come to me and they ask for those answers, but I have the experts that I work alongside with each and every day, and I can ask them the questions. And together we can come out with the better outcome for those families. And I think all professionals need to realize that we don't have those answers, but working together, we can find them. Mm-hmm. And that's a big key.
Yeah. And Carrie, one of the things that I'm fully aware of as we started this hour is that many people across the state turned off their radios because of the topic. This is a difficult thing to talk about. What happens if we don't talk about it?
That's an excellent point. One of our goals is to provide communities, to provide South Dakota with the language to be able to have the discussion. It's a hard discussion, but it's important. We know that when bad things happen to children, they have outcomes or have the potential to have outcomes in their adult life that may make it harder for them to be productive members of society. For example, we know when you have a high score of adverse childhood experiences, you may have negative health outcomes, you may have negative work product outcomes, and you may not be able to establish long and fulfilling relationships with people. So for us to create a stronger South Dakota, not only do we have to empower people to have the conversation, give them the language to have the conversation, but we also have to recognize that childhood maltreatment is a lifelong issue. It is not the child's responsibility, it's the adult's responsibility. And so we are going to empower our South Dakota adults to make changes for our children, which will create resilient families across our state.
I think that's a really good point in when she talks about it's a community problem. This isn't a law enforcement problem. This isn't a gender problem. It's not a female problem, a male problem. It is a community problem. And when I talk about this, I always look out the audience when I'm speaking at groups and I say, where are your husbands? Where are your significant others? And it's an uncomfortable topic, but it needs to happen. And I think we're making some strides, but we're not there yet.
And I think to just add on to what Cam said as well is, a lot of times one of the myths that we tend to hear is, oh, there must be more cases or more victims in certain zip codes or certain cities or parts of our state. You know, our tribal communities must see it more. This impacts everybody, yeah, universally.
Absolutely. Not talking about it doesn't make it go away. And so we have to help people be comfortable with it. You know, as Carrie said, child abuse is an adult problem. I mean, that's we talked over and over again. Mm-hmm. Because we don't make children responsible for their safety in any other arena. Right. So we can't tell them, don't let this happen to you. Because they can't control big people. Yeah. Right. And so that's a huge part of this message. And we do know that kids, if they are safe, if they're nurtured, if we can prevent adversity, they are going to be more productive. They're going to be healthier. Mm-hmm. Their risk of mental health issues, substance abuse, is going to be dramatically decreased. So it's whether you want to address this problem because it's the right thing to do or because you're financially invested in business outcomes, doesn't matter. You're going to get a good outcome.
Mm-hmm. And are we just slowly getting to understand just how some behavior, or maybe this is a question for you, Carrie, mm-hmm, where, you know, you might be in school and you might see a child who has certain behaviors and there's lots going on beneath the surface. We're just really understanding how something that we think might be a problem can actually be a symptom.
Absolutely. And I'll take the first stab at this and then I'll open it up for the rest of the group. But what we're learning is that a lot of the issues that we are facing in our state, the mental health issues, the suicide issues, human trafficking, a core common denominator are that those victims have been victims of maltreatment or bad things happening to them as children. And so when we understand that and go into an environment with compassion, we are better able to provide support and services for those children. One of our major goals for this year and ongoing is educating our educators, our teachers, about how best to respond to issues in the classroom that may be stemming from what's happening at home or in a different environment, and give them the tools to respond in adequate ways. And it's important for us to remember that recognizing trauma, regardless of it's of trauma of an adult coworker or of a kiddo, is going to allow us to act compassionately and then provide the best stable, loving environment to help the healing for that person. So.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk more about that after the break. We need to take a quick break here on SDPB Radio, but stay with us as we talk with representatives from the South Dakota Center for the Protection of Childhood Maltreatment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh, and we're broadcasting live this hour from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB Sioux Falls studio. My guests are from the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment. We've got Jolene Letcher, who is a survivor and an advocate, Dr. Nancy Free with Child's Voice at Sanford Health, Cameron Corey with DCI, and Carrie Sanderson, who's the director of the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment. And Dr. Free, I want to start with you and bounce off of what Carrie was saying before the break, which was these problems that are all intersecting.
Right. So as Carrie talked about schools, we see lots of children who have behavior problems at schools or behavior problems at home. Oftentimes they're sent to their medical provider saying, you know, I'm sure my child has ADHD, or the teacher says. What we know is some of those children will have just your garden variety ADHD. But a lot of those children, their symptoms, behavior is a symptom. And sometimes it's a symptom of stress or toxic stress in a child's life, which might make them inattentive, might make them fidgety or active. It might make them hypervigilant. And so all those things can look like ADHD, But and that's just one example. And so when we talk to our educators, it's really important that they look at each child as individuals, because sometimes what's happening outside of the classroom is manifested big time in the classroom.
So, Jalene, one of the things that can be, and, you know, one of those turn off the radio moments is that feeling of hopelessness that says, you know, but now when we sort of spin it out a little bit, there's almost a feeling of hope and encouragement, even excitement, when you think, like, if we can get to the bottom of this issue, we can get to the bottom of potentially a whole lot of issues. That's energizing, maybe is the right word.
And I think for people that hear it and they go, oh, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to think about it, how do we even try and tackle something that affects 4,000 reported children in the state of South Dakota each year? The fact of the matter is we can't tune it out, because you will interact with it every day. You will face the consequences every day. If you own a business and you have employees, guess what? They're dealing with the outcomes, maybe as a victim, as a secondary victim, you know, but there is hope in all of that. And what we see in that hope, I think, is amongst this group here too, is that when we respond, we allow people to heal. And when people heal, our whole society becomes stronger. That is hopeful. So as much as you may be scared to say something or pick up the phone, and we're here talking about it because stigma is so powerful, and especially in South Dakota, where we know everybody. I mean, you know, we're here getting ready, and Cam goes, oh, someone walks into your lobby. I went to high school with them. Yeah. You know, we know our neighbors, we know our families, our communities are so tight-knit. How do I report something about my neighbor, about my pastor? How do I do that? And what if I'm wrong? And we hear that all the time. And just know that there's the hope and the possibility and the potential of a child is in your hands.
Right.
And would you turn your back on that? And I think, you know, these three can speak to a little bit more alleevating that stigma in the reporting
process.
So
if you're still listening, you're probably in.
You're in. We want you in. Yes. Stay in. Go find some friends. Yeah.
But I want to give people some tools now, because, you know, if the people who are listening are engaged in this and they want to know, what exactly can I do? So where do you want to begin with that? What's the best place to jump into that river and say, how do we educate people?
I'd actually like to start just by overviewing what the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment is.
Yeah.
So the outcome of Jolene's Law Task Force was that the state of South Dakota rose up and came together saying, we want to support the body of work that is ending child maltreatment in our state. And so CPCM, the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, is the movement of professionals who are really changing the scope of how we are acting, reacting, knowing about responding to and preventing child maltreatment in the state of South Dakota. We are focused on six different ideas, goals. What about data in the state of South Dakota? Do we need to address, make stronger, and change? How can we use data better? So data is our first goal. Our second goal is impacting or looking at our healthcare systems. What do we need to do within our healthcare systems, whether they be local, state, tribal, whatnot, to be better, stronger for our victims and to possibly help catch issues with child maltreatment earlier? We need to look at our mandatory reporters. How are we empowering our mandatory reporters to not only know how to report, but know how to view trauma and response systems to issues with our children? We're going to look at the criminal justice system, both on the civil side and on the criminal side. How can we better respond, whether it's a judge, an attorney, a probation officer, somebody working within that system, a defense attorney. We're also going to look at our public awareness, providing our communities the information to be able to have the conversation, to report, to respond. And then finally, we're building an infrastructure to make sure that this is a sustainable task, that we're not going to lose momentum because one of us have an issue where we move on, but that this infrastructure is designed to last. So we have those six goals that we're working on, and we're able to provide communities the technical support, the help to engage and activate some of the programming that's happening. So with that overview, I'd love for our board members, Jolene, Cam, and Dr. Free are all board members for the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, and they'll be able to talk about the movement that we're doing now.
Okay. And so when we look at mandatory reporters, that really does identify how you move the needle. Because if people see it, know how to respond, don't get hung up in the question, what if I'm wrong, but realize, what if I'm right? Mm-hmm. That we are really going to change and improve the response to child maltreatment. To affect that, we're looking at curriculum changes across the board. So for all the helping professions, nursing, medicine related, our school of medicine, for anything within the Board of Regents, there's work being done there. Cam can talk about what's happening with law enforcement. We're looking at educating child protection in ways that are deeper and better. And so that's just one piece of it. We're hoping that the cultural awareness includes the ability to listen, because sometimes that's hard. People start to hear something that might be like, oh, this is going to be awful, I can't do it. Yes, you can. Just take a breath and listen. You don't have to say anything. All you have to do is then tell the child you're going to help them and make that report. You know.
Who are mandatory reporters?
So just about any profession that works with children or has any contact with children. There's a long list that requires from teachers to daycare providers, religious practitioners or some religious practitioners, law enforcement, nurses, medical staff. It really goes through the professions of anyone that has contact with children, teachers.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so Cam, tell us what the initial conversation should be. Dr. Free said, you know, I'm gonna get you help. Talk about that, those initial moments of sort of finding out that something, some kind of maltreatment has possibly occurred.
Yeah.
Take me to that moment.
So, you know, when that happens, it sounds a little bit different, but my focus is actually on the parents and the family that is the caregiver over that child. There are resources available for that child. The child is going to be resilient, but where we really need to work is on those parents. And if those parents feel guilty, fault themselves for what's happening, we try and give them the resources as well. Because if they can keep a healthy home, they also can help their child. So when we're talking with them, I really change my focus onto the parents or that caregiver and how to keep themselves healthy, which will then also resonate to keeping their children healthy. And we work through different resources, mental health, counselors, support groups. We in law enforcement and through the medical community have advocates, victim witness specialists that will educate them and prepare them on different actions their children may face or do, what the next steps are if it does go into a criminal element. But I'll tell you that I think law enforcement, oftentimes people think of us as we arrest the bad guys, then we work for, you know, the families. And really it's vice versa. It's about victim safety, both mental and physical. And then it's about offender accountability, because we need to work on the family, the child, and their mental health before we move on. It can be even traumatic through the system.
So what do you say? What's the first thing you say to a kid when you hear something?
So first thing that I actually talk to them about their future, and you know this has happened to them. But I'm not going to talk to them about what's happened to them. I talk to them about what do you want to do in the future? Because that's part of hope. Mm-hmm. And that's trauma-informed. So once that's happened to them, I'm here for you. Your parents love you. You are still the same person that you were before this happened. What do you want to do in the future? What do you want to become when you get older? And they can be all those things. And that's really what we look at, is not defining them into what has happened, but opening up their eyes that we're going to get through this.
Right.
And we'll get through it together. They're not alone. And they have a whole life ahead of them.
And then what's next?
Can you tell us a little bit about minimal effects interviewing, or minimal effects questions?
So, yeah, I can. So this works in the schools as well, and child protection, and it goes along the lines of focusing on the caregiver, or those that are, whether it's parent, guardian, custodian, or somebody, daycare, could be a educator. And what is happening is, so often right now, is a child discloses something happened, and our first instinct is to ask them questions. And who, what, where, and we don't know how to appropriately, or the general public does not know how to appropriately ask questions to children. And they inadvertently will give the answers to the questions within their question, if that makes sense. And then they'll get the answer, they call in to law enforcement, or they may call in to child protection, and they say, the child told me this. Well, once we get involved with professionals, the child didn't say that at all. In fact, the person that took the disclosure sanitized their words, because you know, children may use a derogatory word to explain what happened to them, and so they change those words. Well, as we go further, that makes that much more difficult. So what?
I'm gonna pause you, Cam. When you say it makes it that much more difficult, I think this is where people's eyes get open to the process that they may not see. But a child may say something, the adult may report it one way, law enforcement finds out it was said a different way. A simple word, right? Simply how they explain genitalia.
Right.
And suddenly, when it gets into the legal system, now it's opened up this question that can put that case in danger.
Right. Yeah.
And finding justice through that course may not be able to happen.
Right.
That's
exactly
so
right.
Important.
Yeah, and because the key then is to try and discredit the child. Mm-hmm. And if somebody were to say that the child disclosed that they were touched on their butt, but in fact, that's not the word that they used.
Right.
Right? Yeah. They used a different word for that part of anatomy.
Now, someone will use that to sort of unravel the case in some ways.
Right.
So consistency is key.
Right. And so
accuracy is key.
Yeah, accuracy. Yeah. And we teach the educators, we teach anybody who takes a disclosure to be verbatim. What did that child say? That's what we need to hear. But we don't need to ask any more questions. Oh. We're done. That's it. You told me this. Great. Now we move on with our day. And, because we're not going to dwell on what's happened.
You have enough to make a report.
Yeah.
Whether you're a teacher, a doctor, a dentist, the lifeguard at the pool, doesn't matter. If you have enough to make a report, we really want people to understand it's important to stop questioning.
Right.
Yes, once that disclosure process has started, people who hear it may have many, many, many questions. But it's much better to not have that child start telling lots and lots of people for a whole lot of reasons.
Right. And if you're close to this child, you're going to think, well, I'm the one that they are going to trust to tell this to. Mm-hmm. And maybe you've watched them on too many episodes of, you know, CSI or whatever. I mean, like, or you might just be terrified and jump into a sort of, I can control this, I can fix this, I can, you know, or retaliation, or all kinds of things can come up in the mind of a parent or
this
caregiver.
Can't be true.
Yeah, this can't
because
be true.
Because some caregivers can't process that, and we get it. Why would you be in a relationship with someone you thought could hurt your child?
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I think is important for us to remember is that part of our ability to respond appropriately is for us to have the knowledge of how to respond. And mm-hmm. so if a caregiver or somebody who has children in their lives, if they could take a moment to think about how you would respond if you were in a situation where a child discloses to you, if you take a moment to educate yourself about what the mandatory reporter number is, and this is my moment to make a plug, in the state of South Dakota, we call it mandatory reporting, but it's voluntary. Anybody in the state of South Dakota can report if they feel harm is happening to a child, mm-hmm. and their duty is not to investigate, their duty is just to report. And then the professionals will take over the investigation. We're excited to say that we have resources that are coming together through the CPCM movement. You can find information on the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment's website that will guide you to our statewide resources, whether it's with the Department of Social Services, the Division of Criminal Investigation, Children's Home Society, Child's Voice, or whatnot. We're happy to provide those resources. But the important thing here to know is the empowerment for that person who's hearing the disclosure that if you take a moment, how would you react and know what you can do next, which is to report, and then where to go to find resources for yourself, for your kid, for the child in your life, and the family if needed.
And Carrie makes a very, very important point that the unfortunate truth is that the majority of our offenders to these children are somebody that is in that child's family. And people are afraid to report in the event that they're wrong. And I like to go, if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. You can remain anonymous when reporting these cases to Child Protection. And a good example is, I was reading in the news, we recently had a tragic case out of Brookings. And this child unfortunately died due to extreme child maltreatment. Well, it's hard for me to believe that there was not people that had some sort of contact with that child. And, you know, but it was never reported. And those are the things.
Do we know that, to be fair, that nobody reported anything?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah,
that.
We don't know the whole case.
Yes,
but let's
I don't know that.
Hypothetically, yeah.
Right.
Hypothetically,
right.
That it's
right.
Possible that it was not that people mm-hmm. had.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So you know, those are things where if you see something, just say something, yeah. And you know, they can remain anonymous because it's hard. A lot of times you're reporting somebody in your family or somebody close to you.
We need to take another break. We'll come back with more on this conversation in just a moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery. This hour we have representatives from the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, Jolene Letcher, Dr. Nancy Free, Cameron Corey with DCI, and Carrie Sanderson, who's director of the center, all with us talking about the importance of having the conversation about child maltreatment, even if it is an extreme or gross, painful, hard thing to talk about. And then the reporting, not investigating, your job is to just make that call and report. And then one of the things I wanted to jump in with, Carrie, and maybe you could start here, is that one of the barriers to reporting can be that you're afraid of what's going to happen next, losing control, losing relationships, going to trial. I mean, your mind is going to sort of spin forward in this catastrophic thinking of, and that might cause a barrier. Talk about a little bit on just one step at a time.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We are trying to empower our families and our communities to know that when we know about bad things, there are resources for us to take the next step. And so even though I, as somebody who might know there's negative consequences coming or could come if I report, hopefully also know that there's support to overcome some of the rough areas that in the future. It's important for me as a parent to know that my children will be healthier and stronger if I report, even though I might be having to face some hard times ahead if the hypothetical abuser was a family member or my only provider of shelter, food, and whatnot. And so the best thing that we can do is really provide access to those resources, which starts with knowing that, one, you should report, and it's important to report, then two, what happens after. We are able to work with, again, our educators, also our medical community, our youth service organizations, and others to provide a unified tool to a family or to a community on how to best respond to trauma. And that information can be found, again, on the CPCM website. And it's also going to be discussed at our conference coming up next week, where we'll have an opportunity to educate community members about what's happening and how our tools are there to respond.
And Jolene, I want to get at this point because is it mostly some child saying something is what I'm getting at? Because we said in the beginning that, you know, children are not responsible for their own safety. Yeah. We can't control what big people do. Right. But so in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, they're going to tell me. What if they don't? I mean, are we talking about other ways of sort of what are the signs? When do I report something that the child hasn't told me that I'm suspicious about?
And I think Dr. Free or Cam can probably talk about that. I can tell you for me personally, it was about being sure no one knew anything was wrong. Mm-hmm. It was about protecting my family. It was about being sure, in my case, my perpetrator put forward that there were consequences. That I had caused things to happen. And to me, my future hung in the balance if anyone knew, because it was my fault. Now, it wasn't. The adult me can tell you that. The child me can't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a very conscious being sure from the outside things looked perfect and hiding everything. Now, there, mm-hmm. with hindsight, there were cracks.
Right.
There were cracks, and now, you know, a lot of people come back and say, you know, I knew something was off when mm-hmm. she lost a lot of weight. She, you know, was really quiet for times. That wasn't like her. These uncharacteristic things. But, you know, nothing outwardly said.
Yeah.
You know,
Dr. Free.
You know, those are very nonspecific symptoms. And so not every child who is quiet for a little bit has been maltreated. But I think we always, as a community, have to think of that as a possibility. And so there are some things that raise your concern more. If a child has a genital injury that's unexplained or extreme changes in behaviors. But what about the child who is acting out or quite withdrawn? One of the things we have to think about is what's happening in this child's world. Yeah. And to at least entertain it as a possibility. Because I think much of what we miss is because we think, this child's quiet because he didn't get enough sleep. Well, maybe why didn't this child get enough sleep? You know, there's usually some reasonable part of that explanation, but it just kind of stops short. And so one step at a time, as you said, is critically important. If a child comes in with symptoms related to their genital tract or with injuries that could be physically abusive, you know, one of the things we do at the very beginning is talk with caregivers and say, this is a process. We work within a team for a reason. Our part today is we're going to medically evaluate your child. But my law enforcement partner, my child protection partner, we all have the same goal, which is for the best outcome of your child. But we all have to do our parts. And so it's a process. Not everything that looks and smells like child maltreatment will turn out being child maltreatment. But there's lots of child maltreatment that goes unrecognized because we don't even entertain it as a possibility.
Right. You know, Dr. Free one time gave me some outstanding advice. I'm a relatively new parent, and she said to me when I was concerned about a potential maltreatment issue with my child, she said, Carrie, would it change how you'd parent? You love them, and you give them a safe, stable environment. And if you can do that while being aware of a possibility, you're going to be able to provide strength for your kiddo. And so I think one of our goals is, again, educating our community to treat each other with compassion, to be aware of the potential of maltreatment, and if maltreatment possibly is there, to be able to report it. The Department of Social Services has a free training on mandatory reporter issues and how to report that is located on their website. And to date, it's been published for the last 3 years. Over 15,000 South Dakotans have logged on to watch that mandatory reporter training video. And we have a second video in the works where we'll continue to discuss a little bit more in depth on how you can better interact with the system once you know or a report has been made.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing for really parents to think about is that to be aware of the singling out of unusual amounts of time spent with one child. Because what we know, this doesn't start one day. The grooming process actually starts with the family members, and they build that relationship, that trust, and then it goes into building that with the children, taking them. If it's one individual child and it's an unusual amount of time, that's something to be raise your awareness. There shouldn't be secrets, and that's something. If there's secrets with another person, and it's not mom and dad or sibling type stuff, those are things that need to be, those are red flags for parents to be aware of.
And Jolene, in our remaining, minute or two, this notion that if nothing is done, it might seem on the surface that we have, nothing to talk about because the child might go to school and they might be fine. They might be successful. They might end up going to college. But the body always remembers what happened, and sooner or later,
it always cracks through. Yeah. And I will say that the pain will crack through at some point. And I am a living embodiment of that, of trying to push back pain. It cracked through. And for me, that is the fuel of hope. That is the fuel of protecting our children. That is, I know also for this entire team up here, that is the idea that we as a state will be sure that no child has to live with that darkness, mm-hmm. and that their life is full of hope and joy and possibility. They deserve that. And when you think about that, if you suspect something, call law enforcement. If today, right now, you are listening to this and something seems off, strange, a child doesn't explicitly disclose, but you think it's weird, do not for a moment think, oh, it's okay if I just wait, because I was that child and no one said anything. And so you don't just speak for them in the now, you speak for them for the rest of their lives.
Thank you for being here with us and all this conversation. Clearly we're not done with the conversation because we're not at zero yet,
right?
Come back again anytime. And the conference, in 5 seconds, where should people find out more?
Absolutely. The 19th Annual Community Response to Child Maltreatment or Child Abuse Conference will be held in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, October 3rd and 4th at the Sioux Falls Convention Center. You can find out more information at www.sdcpcm.com.